welcome everybody to Health, Wealth, and Divine, also known as Juwanza for Life. My name is Juwanza. As promised, we've got another fabulous show lined up for you. For those who listened night before last on Tuesday, you know my special guest was Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author extraordinaire, author of two fabulous books, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, now 105 Business Principles, as well as Finding a Career for Life, The Road to the Top. So I just want to first thank everybody for tuning in. Thank you so much for all of your support. Really appreciate you taking time out to tune in and get this information, and hopefully you're sharing the information, because this is very, very valuable information. And so to all of the entrepreneurs out there, I say welcome. Welcome to class, and I hope that you're ready, because I've got three brand new principles for you. We're going to be, again, discussing the fabulous book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, now 105 business principles. And if you're tuning in for the first time, well, once a month, I'm very fortunate to have as my special guest an entrepreneur extraordinaire, Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Has written two fabulous books, again, one titled Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles, and he's also author of a new book, Finding a Career for Life, The Road to the Top. Doing a series on actually both of these great books, and again, we'll tell you how you can get these books and just really take advantage of the information, because they say information is power, but it's not power if you don't have it. And if you have it, it's not powerful if you don't use it. So I definitely encourage you to not just listen to the show, but I encourage you to get the book. And after you get the book, follow the instructions in the book. So without further ado, let me introduce my guest to you. If you're tuning in for the very first time, Professor Geiger, currently retired, grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over the lifetime of his career, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College in Richmond, Virginia, where he currently resides. Again, as I mentioned, Professor Geiger is a regular on the show, and I encourage everybody, if you're an entrepreneur and you somehow just came across this show, well, we've got an archive. And Professor Geiger has been with us for several years now, and so you can just scroll down the archives, and you'll see his name, and you just click on the icon, and the show will begin, and you can start to really sit down and, at your leisure, sit down and actually listen to and take in this information, because if you're an entrepreneur, it can actually change your entrepreneurial life. And with the book Entrepreneurial Success, there are also life principles as well. So I want to encourage you to do that. Well, Professor Geiger, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you back. We've got three new principles that we're going to discuss tonight, or actually a few more, but your book is growing, my brother. It's just keeps growing.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Professor, could you talk about, you've added three new principles, and, you know, again, as I mentioned, your book just keeps growing, and these principles are dealing with financing your business. I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, when they, you know, start off with a dream, they don't really consider, in many cases, how they're going to finance this thing, you know. So to that end, you've written three more principles, very important principles. Could you talk about, what led you to actually writing these three new principles for your book?
Well, actually, I have somewhat of a speaking schedule, and a professor friend of mine at University of Richmond that has a class of students in business asked me to talk to them, and he suggested a subject of how to finance businesses, because I'd done it so many times. And in my book, I did not have any dedicated principles for that. They were kind of scattered throughout the book, and I thought, you know, now is a good time to try to come up with some very specific principles on how to do that. And so that was kind of the origin. It happened about, six months or so ago. And after doing that, I decided that, this was a great idea, and I'll turn the lecture into three more principles and another 10 pages in the book.
Well, I think that it's very, very important because, and that's one of the things I like about your books, it actually takes you through the process and gives you practical tips and tools, you know, by which you can actually do it. And a lot of times people who have, if, for example, somebody that's on their 10th business like yourself or 11th or 12th, you know, they've been through the process and they know what it's going to entail. But somebody who's just starting out, starting their very, very first business, because this is uncharted territory for them. They've never done this before. And so for you to have written these principles and actually it walks them through a lot of stuff that is coming down the pike. Some things are just going to happen in business, and some things can actually be avoided. And so with that in mind, I think that, you know, just you writing the book in the way that you've written it is, it's just so practical that I recommend the book to everybody. Well, today, again, we're going to be discussing three new principles. Financing a business, very, very important, overlooked, I'm sure, by many. And practical business principle number 16 is finding financing, the traditional ways. It's your show, Professor. Take it away. Let's talk about that, the traditional ways. People have, you know, ways when they're thinking about starting a business. What are the traditional ways?
Well, let me first give you an idea of just how big this is. Between 2007 and 2015, there was an average of about 600,000 new businesses that were started annually every year. So it's huge. There's lots of ways, and the problem that many books have, certainly academia has, is the people who write these books have never really done it, and so they get caught up on various things. So let me give you the six methods that you can finance a business, and maybe there's more, but if there is, I don't think so.
Okay.
Let me know if you find one. The first and the most important and the most commonly used is founders, family, and friends. So the person who starts the business, their family or their friends is where they get the money. And I'll just name all of these, and then we'll go through it during the hour and go through all of these. The second is angel investors. Lots of textbooks talk endlessly about venture capitalists. Once you have a business running, a IPO, initial public offering, and there are those who, I've seen it written in some textbooks, that is sometimes used as a startup method of coming up with money. One that very few people know about but has been around for a long time is what's called Regulation D in the federal code, and it's for private placement offerings, small private placement offerings. And the last one, which people think is very, very new, but in fact, when we get into it, I'll show you how it's been around for a long, long time, and that's crowdfunding.
Okay.
So those are the methods. And why don't I just start down, and you can stop me when you want, Juanza, and we can talk about them even more. We'll start with the first one, family, founders, family, and friends. Of the 600,000 business that start every day, every year, family, founders, family, and friends represents about 90.5% of all of them, or in other words, some 543,000 are funded that way. That is far and away the biggest way. And I think it's in very, very important that, frankly, funding by founders is almost 100%. They play a part, because one of the principles in the new book is principle number 23, which is you must have skin in the game. In the previous book, it was, I think it's number 20. But those are both the same. And a founder, really, you need to have skin in the game. If you're not willing to put up your own money, you're going to have a hard time finding anybody who will help you. So that's a big one. Now, when you're involved with family and friends, a terrible error that very often is made is that source, family and friends, is treated differently than you would treat somebody who is not a family member or a close friend. In other words, if somebody came to me that I really didn't know and said, "Would you help me finance a business?" I might say yes. And however, I would want certain documentation. If I put money up, I want to have actual stock certificates. I may want to have a written agreement. But very often, if the people putting up the money are family and friends, that is not done. And that is a bad mistake. If you want to turn family and friends into enemies, one way to do it is to get them to invest in your business, your new business, and then treat them like a mushroom. And you ought not to do that. You ought to treat them just like they were somebody you didn't know, make sure all the documentation is done, and it's all signed, it's all dated, it's all properly done, everything is noted. And if you've never done it before, where do you go about getting the documentation? Well, you can go to an attorney and spend a lot of money, or you can go online, and nowadays there's some really good sources. One is there's an online site called Business in a Box, and if you just type that in, Business in a Box, it'll come up, and it is you can get a free trial. And there's all kinds of, I think there's something like over 1,700 legal document templates in there. If it has been thought of, it's there. And there's probably several with several different small variations. And you can just copy one of those off, whatever works, and use it. It's free. After you've done some, you might want to save that, and the cost is very modest to get all those documents, so you'll have them at your beck and call. So go to Business in a Box, and it's a terrific site, and you can get the kind of documentation that you need to make sure that your family and friends, anybody who invests in your company, you have all the proper documentation. The company that you start should be a corporation, either an S-Corp, a C-Corp, an LLC, any of those. There's a couple of variations in addition to that, and it should be those. It used to be pretty expensive to form those. Up until the last one I did, I think up until then I had spent $3,000, $4,000 for each corporation, and this was years ago when $3,000 was a whole lot of money. Nowadays, you can get everything done right online, and there is no reason to expend to pay anything more than $200 for the whole thing. Wow. And there's lots of sites that you can go to. If you just type in, just ask a question, incorporate a business. And there's all kinds of sites. And the price goes from over $1,000. The last one I did, I think I spent $200. And the last one I was involved with, a student of mine who didn't have very much money at all, I think she spent $140 to to have a LLC done. So compared with the bad old days, it is dirt cheap. And you get most of what you need, if not all of what you need. And you can, you know, at one company you can, well, the one I used and the one she used, it's the minimum amount for a corporation in was $39 plus whatever the state charged. Here in Virginia, the state charge is $100. So that's why she paid $139. I paid $200 because I'm old and lazy and there's a whole bunch of little stuff that I know how to do, but I was just too darn lazy to do it, so I paid an extra $60 to have all that done. Now, I didn't get a fancy leather-bound book, and I didn't get some other stuff. I didn't get fancy certificates because, heck, you can go to online and you can find stock certificates and print those out, type in what you need, and hit print, and boom, you got it.
Okay.
So doing that kind of documentation is really, really easy. So then you should ask yourself, well, if you don't have any startup cash, what can you do? How can you do it? And frankly, the first business that I ever had, I had no money at all. And the way I was at a private school that my parents had sent me there because I'm dyslexic and I had great trouble reading. And they thought they could help. But the private school, the only reason they took me is because I was from Kansas, a Kansas farmer, and everybody else there was from New England pretty much and from wealthy people. And so I didn't have any money. I didn't have any allowance or anything like that. So I wanted to come up with some money, and I decided that all these young people were asking for, they wanted to read the Sunday New York Times. And so I didn't have any money, so I went around to them and I found 20 of them who would pay for a subscription for the semester. And that gave me the seed money to buy the papers that I could then deliver. And so they actually financed my business. I didn't put anything in it because I didn't have anything to put in it. So you can very often do that, and if you look at that method, it's very often open to people. They don't use it. Why they don't use it, I don't know, but they don't. Go ahead and stop me if you want to, and
okay,
I'll just keep going.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I wanted to bring out a point here, just on the first one, founders, family, and friends as a source of financing. You know, just prior to that, you have written that now that you have completed your business plan and cash flow forecast, you should have determined the amount of cash that you will need to start your business. Where do you find the needed money? So it's important, I think, and if you could elaborate a bit just on, before you even go ask anybody for some money, you know, you better have done a business plan and a cash flow forecast, because tell you exactly how much you need, and you're going to want to present something to the people that you're asking the money for.
Mm-hmm.
So would you say that a person show their business plan? Like you said, you treat your family and friends oftentimes different than you would if you went to a bank or an investor that might want to see your business plan. It would be wise to be able to show them your plan and outline how you, in fact, plan on doing this and that you have a plan, correct?
Oh, yeah. It's way beyond wise. It is absolutely critical. Because just remember, the first person here in this group is founders. That's you. That's your bank account. And unless you want to lose everything in your bank account, you darn well better have a plan. And a business plan, there's two parts to a business plan. One is the written part, the narrative, and the narrative part is a story about the business, what it is, where it is, who's going to do things, what are you going to do, who's going to do those things, when are you going to do them, and how are you going to do them? So it's a written plan, and you can go to a number of places and find the outlines for it. The one I suggest everybody is SCORE, S-C-O-R-E. And there's a SCORE chapter in most cities of almost any size. A city of 50,000 would probably have a SCORE chapter. There's one here in Richmond. It's actually the 12th chapter ever formed. And big cities and small cities, they're all over the place. And if you go online go through their website, which is very good, pretty easy to use, and you look in that, they have a section in there that is an outline of, is this a new business? Is this a going business? What is it? And you can go through the outline. It's a bit intimidating, but it's nowhere near as bad as it sounds. I think the new one is 28 pages, but they're not full pages. It's not 28 typewritten single page pages for darn sure. Some pages only have a line or two, but it takes you, walks you through it, and you should really follow that. It'll help you a lot. The other thing you must have is a cash flow forecast. The narrative part does not talk about cash. The narrative part talks about, as I said, what is it, where is it, who is it, how are you going to do it, what are you going to do, and when are you going to do it. And so that is the written part. The cash flow forecast is to take the written part, and the first year is normally, good ones are 3 years. I've seen some that are less than that. If you're going to try to get public money, it's probably going to have to be a five-year. But at any rate, the first year needs to be monthly, and the next 2 to 4 years are quarterly. And the more detailed you can get, the better. You can find a very good one on my website, theroadtothetop.com. It costs you $15, and it forces you to examine your business in very, very great detail. And when you get through, you will not only know how much money you'll need, but equally important, you'll know when you need it. In other words, come Friday on the third month, if you run out of money and you can't make payroll, you're broke. And if you're going to have $500,000 2 weeks later, that's great. But on Friday, you're still broke. So you need to know when do you need the money as well as how much. And once you know that, then you can start going after trying to develop the funds you need so that they will arrive in the amount that you need and when you need it.
You know what's important as well, since we're on this principle, we're having this discussion, it would behoove everybody that's listening to do this. You know, a lot of times, sometimes when people hear people give tips and, you know, about how they should do it, principles, they feel like, you know, well, I don't need to. Do I really need to do that? You know, maybe I don't have to do that. Well, it would behoove you to do the business plan and the cash flow forecast if you're borrowing money or asking other people for money, because, as Professor Geiger has stated in previous shows, most small businesses fail, or startups fail, within the first year. Now, the people that you borrow the money from or get the money from, if it's a loan, they're still going to want their money back, whether you are successful or not. Okay, if the business fails, they're not going to just be like, okay, well, the business failed. You don't worry about the, you know, $25,000 that I gave you or whatever the amount is. They're still going to want their money back. So it would behoove you to ensure that the business succeeds by doing the cash flow forecast. The $15 that you pay for the cash flow forecast is nothing compared to what you will lose if you don't do it. So just to, you know, make sure that you are doing everything you can to make sure that the people that are investing in you, that you really take serious the fact that, you know, hey, they're going to want their money back. I need to be successful, not just for myself, but I have people that believed in me enough to help me to get this off the ground. So I'm going to do everything that I can do to be successful. Professor,
I think that's absolutely true. But you got to remember, you alluded to it. Half of all startups fail in the first year. 3/4 of them fail by year 3. Now, if you went out and asked a whole lot of people who have businesses, who started businesses, did you do a business plan? You're going to find a bunch of them who did not. And they're among the lucky 20% or so who survived, either by good fortune or luck or whatever. They survived. But just remember that for every one of those who said, no, I didn't do a business plan and it worked out for me, that there's 3 or 4 who didn't do a business plan and it did not work out. Do you want to be in the 20 or 25% that it did work, or are you perfectly happy in being in the 75% to 80% that it did not work out? The way to weight your odds so that you're in the 20 or 25% that it did work is to do a good business plan.
You know, Professor, I'm really enjoying this, and, you know, I want to we might have to do another show, you know, for this, because I want to take our time with it, because this information is very, very vital to the success of businesses. So sticking with Principle 1 for one more statement here, and that is, if you're going to get money from friends and family, you have to give them an incentive, I think, as well, to invest in your business, because there are people who might look at the business plan and they think, okay, that's a nice business plan. Yeah, it sounds like it could work. And yes, I have the money that I could lend you or give you, but what's in it for me? You know, so, you know, what do you have to say about that, Professor? I mean, because there are people that feel like, okay, well, since this is my brother, why is he charging me interest on the money that he's given me? This is my brother. This is my dad. I mean, you know, I mean, should a person be, it's a rhetorical question, but should a person be prepared to give incentives, financial considerations to even friends and family who are investing with them?
Absolutely. What's the difference? The big difference with friends and family is you get an audience. You get them to listen to you when the vast majority of people won't give you the time of day. They won't listen to you. They don't give a damn about your plan, what you're doing. They could care less. Well, friends and family care for you and that they're giving you an audience. But since when is their $100 less valuable than $100 from a bank or $100 from an angel investor, somebody you don't know? It's still $100. That part should be the same. The big difference is that with friends and family, you get a sympathetic audience that you do not get when they're not friends or family. But what you offer them should be the same. I mean, let's put it on the other foot. You have 3/4 of your investing, your money comes from friends and family, but 1/4 of it doesn't. It comes from others. So the others, you say to them that, you know, I can't pay you any interest, but in X number of years when you want to sell, and normally if it's a angel investor, within 3 to 5 years they're going to want to sell their interest in it, and they want to sell it for 2 to 5 times what they put in. Why should they get 2 to 5 times what they put in and your friends and family get nothing? They don't get that. What's going on here? I don't understand that. So just because Oliver Geiger is my brother doesn't mean that I ought to offer him the same as I would offer Juwanza, who I know casually. I should offer everybody the same. Treat them all the same. But Oliver will listen to me. And Juwanza might say, hey, friend, go pal Sam. I don't know you. I'm not going to give you anything. And which would be a perfectly reasonable response.
You know, you mentioned angel investors, Professor. Great segue into principle number two in this section.
Well, actually, this is all in the first one, principle number 16.
The next
friends and family, angel investors, venture capitalists, and IPOs. So the second part of the next part is an angel investor. And angel investors, of this 600,000 per year new businesses, angel investors represent approximately 9.3%, or in other words, 56,000 of the investors are angel investors. And an angel investor is somebody who invests relatively small amounts, normally from $25,000 to $500,000 in a new business. Mm-hmm. Typically, they want to sell their investment in that new startup within 3 to 5 years. Very often, they end up selling it. Well, the majority of the time, they will sell it to the founder. And most of them will want a buy-sell agreement, which I don't think I want to get into because it gets pretty involved. But you can certainly find a buy-sell agreement or a number of them in Business in a Box. If you go to that website, get into that and ask to look at a buy-sell agreement, they'll have them, and you can look and see what it is. And a typical angel investor will wants a buy-sell agreement. And they are a whole lot more interested in the sell part than they are the buy part. They don't really want to buy you out, but the only good agreements that really work out are buy-sell agreements because they work for both sides, and it's fair to both sides. So normally they'll want that, and normally an angel investor will want to sell out within 3 to 5 years, and then they invest in somebody else. And the common return on investment they're looking for is 3 to 5 times their original investment. And that may seem pretty steep, but if somebody invested $100,000 in your business and 4 years later you pay them $400,000, where do you get the money? Well, you get the money from your business. And if it wasn't for their $100,000, the darn business wouldn't exist. And so usually they'll come up with payment plans because that's what they want. They want you to succeed. They want the business back. They want it to do well, but they want a pretty handy return on their money. And the other thing that angel investors do is they're excellent business advisors. They sure beat the heck out of somebody who calls himself a advisor, because the angel investor has skin in the game. They want you to succeed, and generally they don't charge for their time because they want the business to succeed. Otherwise, they won't get there 3 to 5 times. Plus, they generally have an emotional attachment to this thing. So you get money from them, but you also get excellent business advice. I have gone to a couple of times. I've had angel investors, and I've gone to them, and I remember really well. And I one of the first times, and I called up this guy who had invested with me, and I was really worried. And so he listened to my tale of woe. And when he got all through, he said, "Well, Joe, that sounds about right to me. That's how I started out. So hang in there, keep at it. And I would suggest you do a couple of things," which I most certainly did do. And it was great advice. So that is the other big plus of angel investors. How do you find an angel investor? If you go to Score, They'll have it if you type in your city and type in there and ask for business investors. You'll probably find a group or two that are listed, then you can go to them and see if there's anybody there interested in what you're doing. So they're pretty easy to find.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
They're pretty easy to find, and they're by and large pretty nice folks. You don't hear somebody who wants to rip you off. They're not going to make it very long as an angel investor, because the other people in the group will find out about it and they'll throw them out.
So will the person, the representative at, say, SCORE, match you with an angel investor that has experience in your industry? Because if they're going to give business advice, you know, it seems like it would help if they knew something about your business, you know what I mean? So would that be a part of, with SCORE, or if you're searching out one, even if you don't go through SCORE, to find out one that, interviewing them, you know, before you even, if they say, okay, just because they say, hey, I got the money, look, I like your business, yes, I'll do it. But if they have some sort of an idea of your business and the industry that you're in, you know, like, for example, let's say if you're in an industry and it's, you know, it's cyclical, okay, then, and the angel investor knows this and you're going through a rough patch, you know, then it would be easy for that person to say, okay, hey, listen, you know the business is up and down, it's cyclical, normally around this time of year, you know, sales are slow or whatever the case is.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it would help if they knew something about your business to be able to advise.
Well, put the shoe on the other foot. You know something about the broadcasting business. Would you invest in something, a small business that you had no idea of? No, you probably wouldn't. If somebody came to you with an investment in broadcasting, in promotion, and that sort of thing that you do know, would you be more likely to invest? Absolutely. So that pretty well solves itself, because if you find an angel investor who made his money in the oil and gas industry, and you have an investment in women's ready to wear, unless he wants to cut his wife into it, chances are he doesn't have any interest in that, because
mm-hmm.
he doesn't know it, and
mm-hmm.
that's sort of self limiting, because the angel investor is going to want to invest in things that he knows. And if he doesn't know about it, he isn't going to do it. And I've seen that over and over. I knew one in California very well. I got to know Saul very, very well. He was nutty over airplanes. I sold him an airplane. He was retired, and all he did was invest in real estate and startups. And
mm-hmm.
And he never invested in something he wasn't a blooming expert at. There was a number of things he was an expert at. I mean, it wasn't just one or two things, such as real estate. He certainly was an expert at that, but he was an expert at two or three other things, and that's what he would invest in. And he would get lots of business plans, because he was pretty well known. His people never failed. He was a tough taskmaster. But if Saul gave you the money to start up, you were going to succeed. He would make darn sure you would succeed if he had to drag you screaming and kicking all the way to the bank, but he would not invest in things he didn't know about.
Yeah, that makes sense, because if he's looking at business plans, and even though it could be a very well-written business plan, if you don't know anything about the business, you don't know if the business plan,
yeah.
if the projections are even feasible. You don't even know if they're, you know, outlandish or not. I mean, if you don't know anything about the business, so I can see that.
He knew other people. So if you came to him with something that he wasn't interested in, but he thought it was a good one, he might tell you to go see someone else who he thought might be interested in it. He was a great guy, tough business person, but a great guy.
You know what?
Okay.
Sometimes those people, though, those tough, they want to make you succeed. And they, again, if they're putting skin in the game, which is, of course, going to increase their desire for you to succeed, then, you know, hey, tough is not bad. Tough is good.
Yeah, tough is very good. Very, very
if they
good.
Dragging you screaming and hollering to the bank, yeah, it's great. So, okay, venture capitalist.
Okay, venture capitalist. If you read, if you go to entrepreneurship classes and you read the textbooks, you would think by that venture capitalists are a major, major source of financing new businesses. Last fall I had a entrepreneurship class at John Tyler College here in the greater Richmond area, and the textbook, I hated it. And as a matter of fact, I really wouldn't use it. I mean, I had to use it, but what I did is I bought textbooks that were good textbooks for all of my class people. And they were only $9, so I could buy them online used for $9 or $10. So I bought them all textbooks. That's the one we really used. And the textbook that the school had picked for me, it was picked by people who had never started a business, never run a business. They didn't have, I mean, they'd worked in businesses, but as far as a small business, they didn't know any more about that than I know about nuclear physics. Frankly, I think I know more about nuclear physics than they do. And in that textbook, they talked about venture capitalists over and over again. Well, let me tell you about venture capitalists. Of the 600,000 of new businesses formed every year, venture capitalists finance on average 1,200 of them. In other words, 0.2% is what they financed. So if somebody tells you that you ought to go see a venture capitalist, right off the top, you can be pretty well assured 99% of the time they don't have a clue what they're talking about. And if they refer to some professor or some academic who wrote a textbook and that's what they recommend, that guy doesn't have a clue either. 0.2% is such a tiny, tiny fraction that even if these guys were first rate, they would be terrible because they only help 0.2%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just stupid to spend any time worrying about them. So venture capitalists they get lots of ink, lots of publicity, because they're very often the ones that finance some of these new tech giants who came to them and, you know, they started out with, they wanted to do Facebook, and so some venture capitalists or Apple or one of those, and the venture capitalists put in $3 million, and the company turned out to be a $10 billion company. Well, that happens. But it is so rare that it is not worth even discussing. And the only reason I bring it up is to try to dissuade young entrepreneurs to spend any time at all worried about a venture capitalist. The other one that is even worse than that is IPO. An IPO is an initial public offering. And if you read or listen to business news very much, you'll hear about this IPO and that IPO, and the people who started the business had an IPO on their business, and they came out being worth $500 million or more, and they still had control of the business. You know, these fabulous amounts. Well, let me tell you about IPOs. Between 2011 and 2014, there were a total in the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and the American Stock Exchange, there was a total of 824 in those 11, 12, 13, in those 4 years. There was, in other words, there were 206 a year. Of all the millions and millions of small businesses that are out there, there are 206. So that is not a tiny amount. That is an infinitesimally small amount. And if you put in your business plan that the way you're going to pay off your investors is with an IPO, if I read that business plan, when I read that part, I would close it up and wouldn't read another word, because I know right off the bat that you had no clue of what you were talking about, because that's not going to happen. IPOs don't happen. Now, yeah, they do happen. 206 of them a year happen out of millions of businesses that are out there. But that is such a small, I don't know whether that is 1/100th of 1/1000th of a percent, but it's a tiny, tiny percent. The only reason I bring it up is do not put that in your business plan, that an IPO is going to be the exit plan for your investors, because it's not. And any smart investor will read that and they'll react the same way as I do. They'll close it up and throw it in the trash, because that's what it's worth.
So the IPO, though, is it's to raise funds. It's to raise money. Okay.
Yeah. It's an initial public offering that goes out. Normally they're for millions of dollars. Sometimes they're for big companies. I mean, of that 206, there are some very big companies that spun off a division, and the way they funded the division is with an initial public offering. So it raises, and the initial public offering means that the company is now on the stock exchange and can be bought and sold one share at a time. Or 100 shares or whatever.
So the people that invest in the IPO are banking on the company's potential, correct?
Yeah, either that or the bigger fool theory.
Okay.
Frankly, I think much of it is the bigger fool theory.
The reason I ask, I know, works for a company, and they just had an IPO, and they were wondering, should they invest, should they buy, because they were offering the company, the employees, I guess, stock at a reduced,
mm-hmm.
I guess, rate. So, you know,
that's great for the employees, because mm-hmm. they can decide. Well, it depends. I mean, sometimes they offer it at a very reduced rate, but they can't sell for quite a while. Other times
mm-hmm.
there are no restrictions, so you want to know what the heck the restrictions are. But if a company comes to you and says we're going to do an IPO, the initial offering is for $10 a share, and we'll sell you shares for $5 a share because you've been a good employee. And then 3 weeks from now, the IPO will come out, and if you want to keep it, fine. If you want to sell, fine. That's a home run hit, because you probably are going to be able to get your money back and a big profit right quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as a business thinking that a new startup thinking an IPO is the exit strategy for investors, that's just never,
crazy.
Never mind. Absolutely. That is worse than Alice in Wonderland.
Well, Professor, we've got about 10 minutes left. Do you want to try, because we would be moving into Principle 17, finding financing Regulation D, where you get when you need big money. Do you want to try to do that, or you want to?
Well,
we can talk
I can take a shot at that, and then if we have to review it later, we can. Reg D is from the Security Act of 1933. It was put out there during the Depression as a method of trying to offer a way for small companies to finance themselves. And it's still on the books. You are a public offering, but you're not registered, And the Security and Exchange Commission, the federal government Security and Exchange Commission, does not know you exist and does not care to know you exist. They pass no judgment. They don't. You don't send them anything. They're not in the equation. With an IPO, they are. Now, there's some restrictions. Today, you can do a Reg D for up to $5 million in any one calendar year, or in any 12 months, not calendar year, but in any 12 months, I think is the current verbiage. I did one, and when I did it, you could only raise $2.5 million, and at that time, it was in any calendar year. So if you raised what I did is I raised $2.5 million, and I did it in probably October and November, and then in January I did another one for $2.5 million, and okay. You can do a second one, but they've changed that now, so it's in any 12 months. So if you finish off one in December, you cannot start another one. Let's say you finished one on the 20th December. You cannot start the next round until the 21st of December of the next year, 12 months later.
And you said the max is $5 million per year?
I believe it's $5 million. Now, that's a bit of a moving target, so don't take my word as gospel. You just type in Regulation D and read the darn thing, and there you go. And it's not, I mean, it was written so that people could do it originally with the thought that they could do it by themselves. Now, when I did it in about 1970 or so, by that time, if you talked Regulation D, everybody told you you had to go to a stock brokerage company and have them do it. And when I asked about that, they told me that the cheapest I found was $250,000 in cash, but they were pretty upfront about telling me that chances are it'll take a little more money than that, and there is no guarantee at all that they would be able to raise 5 cents. So, it was a bit bleak. And I decided that I didn't have the $250,000 in cash to spare. So I thought, well, why don't I find out what it's like to do it myself? And what I did, I called up some other brokerage companies and played investor and got them to send me. I ended up with three Regulation D offerings. And I read through them. Each of them was about 100 pages. So when I first got them, oh, my God, this is just incredible. What I found out was that probably 85 of the 100 pages was boilerplate. It was all the same. In many cases, they use exactly the same words. I mean, all paragraphs were all the same. So I copied all that stuff down, and then I did my own. And once I figured out how to do it, I raised $250,000 or $2.5 million, and then 3 months later I started again, and at that time it didn't take quite so long. It took about 3 months, and I had another little over $2 million. So it worked out really well, and there are investor seminars you can go to. And the advantage of going to a brokerage company is they know all these seminars. Very often they're part of giving them, and they go and they do a pitch for you, and they pitch what they call a red herring, which is what your Regulation D is called. So I went to a bunch of those and I got nowhere. And then in the book I tell you the story of how I found out to do it a different way, and basically it was the same way as I financed my first paper business. In other words, the first paper business, I went around and got 20 students to take subscriptions and pay me in advance for the subscriptions, And with the Reg D one, I contacted my I was building yachts at the time, or wanting to, and I'd already done some, and then this was restarting the company with a different set, and a slightly different set of boats. And so I contacted the people who were interested in buying the boats, and as a friend who gave me the idea said, if you can afford a $750,000 play toy yacht to go fishing in, you darn well can afford a $100,000 investment in a yacht company. And he was absolutely right. Yeah. So that's the Reg D. And so it can be done. Everybody will tell you it cannot be done unless you're a brokerage company. Well, I'm here to tell you that not only can be done, I did it. And I'm not all that smart. I can read, and I read the Reg D's, and I read the three offerings that I had, and I just wrote my own offering and put in the boilerplate, and away it went.
You know, you said something too, Professor. You actually said that you sat down and you read the Reg D. You read it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And although it was tedious, a lot of reading, it's important to read, you know, and I just want to stress
yeah.
that to people. Because sometimes people will pay somebody else to do it for them. If you don't know it yourself, then you're at a disadvantage.
Oh, boy.
So
big time. big time. You are definitely at a big disadvantage, and you're going to make errors, and chances are they're going to be very costly. So I would strongly recommend that even if you find somebody to do it for you, and you have the what was back then 250, God knows what it is now, with the stock market at just as high as it is. I have no idea what it is. But even if they're going to do it, you need to read it yourself, because
mm-hmm.
you got to sign a whole bunch of stuff. And if somebody else puts some fraudulent stuff in there and you sign it, guess who gets to go to jail? Not them. I'll give you a clue here. It's not them who goes to jail. It's you.
Oh,
and it's you who gets sued, not them.
Mm-hmm.
So just you better read it yourself. And not only read it, but darn well understand it. And if that means you got to reread a couple of paragraphs a dozen times, so be it.
You know, Professor, again, you know, we've got another principle. That would be Principle 18, which would be crowdfunding a new way. So we'll take that up. We'll do another show, everybody. And, you know, just want to make sure that everybody understands that this information that you're hearing can make the difference, can be the difference between your business succeeding and failing. Okay? There are a lot of different ways to start, you know, to get the financing. Professor has given us six. Like you said, if you know of a seventh, let them know. Maybe in the next show, too, we can talk about the Small Business Administration, and you know, I'm sure you got thoughts
yep.
on that as well. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I've been down that road, too. If there's a road out there that has to do with small business, I probably traveled it, and I've got the sores to show where I stumbled and fell. So, yeah, one last thing I would
yep.
like to say is how you can get my book. You can get it at Amazon, or if you'd like to get signed copies, you can get it at theroadtothetop.com. And both books and the cash flow forecast are available there. The difference between my books and others is that my principles are executable, and most of the others are not.
Mm-hmm.
And by executable, I mean you can actually do them. And most of the stuff that I read in business journals and in books and in textbooks is not executable. You cannot do it. It may give you some neat ideas, but if you follow what they say step by step, you can't do it. With mine, if you follow it step by step, you can.
And you know what, I'm going to speak because I've read the books, okay? I can personally vouch for the books because I've read them. As a matter of fact, Entrepreneurial Success, I've read several times, and it's really a great book. I mean, it's a type of book that you will look forward to reading. You know, it's not like one of those books that, you know, where you're, let's say, for example, you know, you've been instructed to read a book, you know, as a class assignment or something, you know. But this is a book that you will enjoy reading. You will actually really enjoy reading the book. And, you know, I'm not getting any kickbacks or anything, you know, because I'm promoting the book. I'm promoting the book because it's promotable. It's worth it needs to be promoted. Actually, both of these books need to be mainstream because the information is just invaluable, you know. So I want to encourage everybody to get both books. Go to theroadtothetop.com and Professor Geiger will sign the book. You know, you'll sign them both, correct, Professor?
I sure will.
So everybody, again, if you know of an entrepreneur, it's not easy to go out here and take an idea that you have. It could be the best idea in the world, but if you don't get it out of your head onto the paper and then do a business plan and a cash flow forecast so that you can effectively execute this plan and take this wonderful idea that you have and bring it to fruition, then, you know, that's what these books are for. Okay, to help you to do that. And if entrepreneurship is not your thing and you just want to go into, you know, you're undecided on a career, you definitely want to get Finding a Career for Life, The Road to the Top, as well. We'll be doing another show on that as well. So stay tuned. I will let you know when that will be. Professor Geiger, thank you again. Any parting words?
No, nothing. Looking forward to the next time.
Okay. I'll be with you very shortly to find out when that will be, probably within the next few days if you're available, because, again, this information is very, very powerful. Thank you so much for the new principles. Very, very important. You better stay tuned, everybody, because Professor, he's coming up with these principles. There may be some more. So, Professor, thank you so much. I'll be in touch.
Good enough. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Everybody, that's Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Again, I encourage you to get both of his books because you're going to need them. If you're in business, and I always say this when I interview Professor Geiger, if you are serious about being a successful entrepreneur and not one of the negative statistics of one of the half that fail within the first year, half of all startups fail within the first year, you don't want to be in that number. Increase your odds of success. To be a successful entrepreneur, you need all the help that you can get. Okay? You need all the advice that you can get. And not just from anybody. You need advice from people that know what they're talking about. I guarantee you, if you get this book, you'll be glad that you did. You'll be, you know what? Jawanza was right. This is a good book. I wouldn't lie to you. Everybody, my name is Jawanza. Thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate you tuning in. I encourage you, share this information. If you love this show, then wouldn't you share it with other people if it's beneficial to you? Wouldn't it be beneficial to someone that you know? So I encourage you to do that. Also, just to let you know, you can leave me a message. You know that, right? You can actually, first of all, let me say this. You can follow the show on Blog Talk Radio. If you like the information that you're hearing and you want to be notified every time I'm doing a show, all you have to do is follow the show on Blog Talk. And every time that I do a show, regardless of the guest, you'll be notified, okay? You can also leave me a message through Blog Talk, okay? Just let me know how you're enjoying the shows, if you're enjoying the shows, any guests that you would like to hear, okay? If I can get them, I'll get them, okay? Again, but keep it in the context of the show. The name of the show, Health, Wealth, and Divine, three categories. If your idea falls within one of those categories, I'll certainly consider it. So, until our next show, by the way, I've got a new a new addition to the Jawanza for Life family, and that is Sister Marietta Preston. She's going to be coming on within the next week, I guess, and we're going to be talking about Kundalini Yoga. You into Kundalini Yoga? Well, definitely. This is what you need to do. You need to follow the show, okay, and then you'll be notified exactly what day and time that she'll be coming on, okay? All right. Until the next time, everybody, thank you again. Who am I? I am the one who, in giving, receives more.